Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee here with our head coach, Chad Timmerman.
Hi, everybody.
And our CEO, Nate, I almost said head coach. You're not our head coach, that's Chad. Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are going to answer, hopefully, some of your cycling questions today. Maybe you haven't submitted them directly to us for this. We're going to do a deep dive on a topic that, a hot topic, dare we say?
Yeah.
on a topic that's been particularly applicable to us as of late. If you listened to the last episode in the Carson City off-road recap that we did, you'll know that all three of us suffered in the heat.
Basically wilted.
Yeah.
It was so bad.
Really hot. And I had kind of a knee-jerk reaction, and I thought, I'm going to train in the shower all the time, right? So I did a workout in the shower, and then we thought, let's actually do some research behind this. So we've got some studies that we're going to be referencing here and trying to stick as close as we can to the facts with this, but also our goal with this is not only to give you that knowledge, but really show how this can help you get faster, not just do well in heat.
Yeah, because that what Jonathan just said about training in the shower, of turning the shower on, putting your trainer in the bathroom and working out for some period of time, that's like the conventional wisdom. But hopefully what you're going to get out of this is, how hard should I be working out? When should I do? How long do the effects last? What kind of power benefit should I get? Should I get it in hot and cold? So I've also done it once since then, so we have some anecdotal experience. But there's also some studies we're going to reference about how, like, very specific, and this has been well documented and reproduced, of doing X gives you a Y boost in performance, which is amazing. I've even seen on one somebody writing about it. It's almost similar to doping, like, yeah, of how much a benefit you can get, but it is way more painful than doping. Not that I know what doping
it's
feels
pretty
like.
Uncomfortable.
Wait,
rewind.
If you, I am the world's worst doper.
Yeah, if that's the case, if you dope, you are terrible at it. Yeah.
Thanks, hey, Jonathan. That was a little bit too enthusiastic, Jonathan.
I've used that very same response multiple times for myself. So, it's actually, and the interesting thing that you somewhat hinted at there, Nate, is that this isn't just benefits in heat, but this is benefits across the board in terms of performance. Mm-hmm. Pretty mm-hmm. cool stuff.
Yeah, there is a veritable wealth of information on this particular topic out there. It wasn't hard to come by.
It's the nice thing is it's easy to test. You put someone in a hot room and they tell you to do something, and then you do it again. And so anyways, first thing that I keep saying wrong, Chad, acclimatize versus acclimate. And I've seen them used interchangeably.
Yeah. So basically, when you acclimate or acclimatize to a particular environmental stressor, you're just adapting to it. So whether it's brought about by artificial means or natural means is where the distinction lies. So acclimation is done by artificial means, whereas acclimatization is done by natural ones. So, you know, whether you go into a heat chamber and acclimate, or you go outside and ride your bike in the heat and acclimatize, two different things.
I'm going to totally be
same
that
outcome
jerk,
though.
I'm going to be that jerk and be like, you were acclimating, not
acclimatizing.
Yeah. Nope, we're going to avoid that entirely, because we're going to refer to all of this from this point forward as simply heat adaptation.
I can't even say that word. Heat adaptation. I've even seen, though, in a study where someone said they said the difference between those two. Mm-hmm. Then they're like, but we're just going to use it interchangeably, because pretty much everyone does.
And really, it's the same outcome. It's you're seeking a particular form of adaptation. In this case, heat adaptation.
Yeah. So, and forgive us if we do, for some reason, instead of using adaptation, misuse one of those terms.
Actually, we'll
hopefully you'll understand.
We will use those terms here and there, but I'm going to do my best to use them in the proper context.
Yeah. I marked my shower training workout on Strava with the wrong term. No one called me out on it, but I did.
Yeah, that would be acclimation.
Yeah, I did it wrong. So
you did the Z one?
I want to go back. Yeah, I did the Z one. I want to go back and just put heat adaptation training.
Okay, so do it.
So should we cover this first from kind of like, I know this is apparent perhaps to people, but identifying the problem, like why heat makes you slower or what generates heat?
Yeah, that's the crux of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's basically rate limiting. So the amount you can do, or the amount of work you can do in a cool environment or a temperate environment, drops off drastically as the heat goes up. So it's just another form of stress that you have to deal with, and your body prioritizes its response to heat before your request for, you know, more muscle contribution or whatever it is.
So you don't die.
Yeah, exactly. It's a self-protective mechanism. So you have to deal with the heat. You have to offload that heat stress, and that comes at the expense of everything else you want your body to do.
And this is one of those reasons too why we always talk about when you're doing your hard, intense interval training, to have a fan on you, mm-hmm. and a lot of air, which we've just have we posted about the Good Fan yet?
Yeah, we actually haven't mentioned it, but it's the Lasco Performance, I believe, U15701. So that thing throws a serious beam of air. It's pretty tightly kept. It doesn't spread out, but it's a lot of velocity.
I use two of them.
Yeah, and it actually brings up an interesting point because we'll get to this later, but ways you can, you know, bring about or create a delve into acclimation is by simply removing the fans from the equation.
Heat adaptation.
Yeah.
There
it is. So work, adapt to heat.
So that's kind of a way to work yourself gingerly into things, perhaps, right? Kind of work yourself down.
It can be. It depends how hard you're working.
Let's hold off on how to get into it.
Yeah,
and let's find out
ourselves.
What happens. So your rate limited. You can't work out harder because you're getting too hot, right? Mm-hmm. And your body starts to not be able to perform as well.
Yeah, basically it devotes resources to cooling, resources that you could be using to power the pedals, but it's simply not going to allow you to.
And it's still a pretty, and when you look at all the resources that are being consumed by your body when you're working, a relatively small amount is actually going to turning the pedals compared to what's just going to cool yourself off.
Yeah. 23 to 25%, depending on how efficient you are.
Yeah.
Another thing is too, is they've done research on this, and it's usually limited by your core temperature of when it happens. So you could, I saw something a long time ago where I had Matt Lieto. He went to Matt Lieto's brother. He was an Ironman athlete for Kona, and he swallowed, I think it was him, a thermometer, and he rode.
Oh, yeah.
And they tried to do different like cooling techniques to see what was the best way to get his core temperature down. The other standard way is you stick it up the wrong end.
Yes.
And that's where a thermometer lives. Yeah. So if you have a study like this, make sure it's the swallow kind of thermometer.
Because that would be uncomfortable on a
bicycle. It would be uncomfortable on a bicycle.
Yeah. Not that swallowing a thermometer might be uncomfortable too. But so I guess, your muscles, we're talking at a very small level. They're just a bunch of little heat generators. They're generating a lot of heat, and that limits our capacity like you're talking about.
Yeah, right? And we can dive into some of these basics right here. But, you know, body core temperature is really strictly regulated, right? It has to, it wavers about in a very narrow range. I mean, typically, you know, we reside right around 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, 37 Celsius for those of you who go by Celsius. And then the range in which it fluctuates is not a wide one. I mean, we're talking down to 95, maybe up to 106, but even as low as 102 degrees Fahrenheit, your nervous system starts to regulate what your muscles are going to do. So it's called central fatigue. It will actually rate limit, you know, how much work your body can do because it's more concerned with cooling you off and, you know, not allowing you to overheat, heat stroke.
So what are the main ways that people can get cool, like cool when they're training? That's the conductive versus
Yeah. Right? So the different types, and I got to be honest, I'm not particularly good at interpreting the difference between conduction and convection. They seem really similar to me, but conduction is like if you sit on a metal chair, your skin temperature transfers to the chair or vice versa.
You're in a cold room.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And then convection involves fluid motion. So basically water or air across the skin. And then of particular interest to us is evaporation. And that's the dissipation of heat when the sweat on your skin turns to a gas.
Yeah, so that's a big thing too is people who, it's not just working on a cold room because the majority of your cooling does come from evaporative cooling, which is convection. And I'd rather just call it evaporative cooling because that makes more sense.
Sure. Right.
And
that's where I was going with that.
Yeah, a cold room, you can think of conductive, but just whenever I think of convection, I think of like cooking a turkey.
In an oven.
And primarily what we're concerned with is evaporative cooling anyway. So that's basically what we're going to talk about.
And just covering that really quick, something that I think a lot of people don't understand is the fact that just merely sweating doesn't mean that you are effectively, doesn't mean that it's effective evaporative cooling, right?
Exactly. If it's just sitting on your skin and it's not evaporating, it in fact is not evaporative cooling.
It's kind of like putting like a little layer of jelly heat all around your body,
right? Yeah, it's like encasing yourself in a film that doesn't let you cool off.
Yep.
And so how that would be different is where you live because the humidity or where you're racing.
Yeah, we'll get to the impact of humidity, but it's a big one.
But so in Reno, it's drier. Mm-hmm. And pretty much, I don't think I've ever, as long as there's some kind of airflow, I've never sweated so much during a race where I'm like dripping. It just cools off and it evaporates.
It's pretty rare. I mean, you'd really have to be, it'd have to be unique circumstances for that to happen up here.
It basically happens on climbs, you know, where the air gets really still and you're doing a lot of work and the sun's just beating down on you.
Yeah, it's also a very windy area, which that's another important component here. You know, you need something, you need that
airflow.
Yeah.
But if you're at something like Hawaii or Sacramento, the Midwest, the South.
All those poor people doing Kona.
The Philippines.
Yeah.
Oh, geez. Yeah. We were, when we walked around, just walking around at Kona, and we didn't really have I was never, I hadn't been in heat like that, I think, all summer.
Yeah.
And it was hard just to walk. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how you guys do the actual race.
It's amazing.
Race. Right. We do know. It's basically acclimatization. And we noticed this over the course of just being there for a few days. I started to sweat less. It was a little easier to deal with the heat. And that took place over, you know, what, the span of 3-4 days.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Still very much impressive, of course. Yeah. Even though we can break it down and figure out how it works there. So.
But basically, with this evaporative cooling, what we're talking about is sweat. Mm-hmm. So this is really a matter of, you know, how well we can teach our bodies to sweat or adapt them to proper and profuse sweating.
I just want to make sure there's the takeaway that everyone understands is that it's more effective in dry conditions. And if you go into a humid condition, there's probably even more reason
things change
to do.
A bit.
What'd you say, Chad?
Things change a bit.
And there's more reason to be heat. Have heat adapted.
Heat adapted, yeah. And really, if at all possible, if you know you're going into a hot and humid environment, if you can do some of your heat adaptation training in a humid environment, for instance, and we'll talk about this more later too, but for instance, the shower sessions that Nate and Jonathan are talking about, very realistic, very specific to what you're going to face.
So before we get into the studies, let's talk about what happens when you are heat adaptive. What changes in your body?
Yeah, so quite a bit. And let me point out from the very start here, a lot of this is culled from a meta study in medicine and science and sports. And the authors are Periard, Racines, and Sauka.
What's a meta study?
It's basically just an amalgamation of many different studies. And they just consolidated into one resource, cite all those studies. And there are a lot of them in this one.
That's a big word. I like to say a study of studies.
There you go.
Yeah. A compilation.
Study of studies or meta study is a little more concise, but maybe not as... It's clear. Okay. So quite a bit happens. You develop a tolerance to exercising heat. And basically your body gets better at offloading heat. Mm. And you see this both in the form of, you know, core temperature reduction and then, of course, skin temperature reduction and the interaction between the two. Mm. So one of the many things that happens is your whole body capacity for heat dissipation goes up. It increases. And you gain a higher level of sweat sensitivity in that your sweating occurs sooner. It occurs at lower core temperatures. Your body gets this sense of, you know, what's coming, and it starts to pre-cool, sort of.
So we get this question a lot, and some people say, how can I sweat less?
Right, people think it's bad.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and let's be clear, it's not. That's a body that's attuned to what's coming. Mm-hmm. So you've basically cultivated this better sweat sensitivity. It's absolutely desirable, and it's a mark of improved fitness.
And there's also, though, some people just genetically, just people sweat more, right? So these adaptions you're talking about are kind of relative for a single person and can't be compared between people.
To further that point, let me scroll back up here. Sweat rates, they've been measured ranging all the way from 0.5, you know, someone with just a
0.5 what?
0.5 liters.
A what?
Per hour of sweat. All the way up to 4 liters. So massive difference.
4 liters?
Yeah.
That's
me, and that's the extreme end of things. More commonly, it's a liter to the high end is a couple liters an hour.
Okay.
Wow. It's quite a lot.
That gives you an idea, though, if you are sweating a lot, that like my two bottles or whatever for 4 hours, I probably did lose a lot of water, even though I wasn't as heat adapted. Mm-hmm. But also another good point is if you are more heat adapted, you have to then think about your hydration strategy because you might sweat more.
Yeah.
You're cooling better. You're going faster. You're actually putting out more power. But you have to also think that you might need to drink more water than normal.
Yeah, and that's absolutely a concern. You have to match. I mean, you don't have to match exactly, but you have to recognize that if your body's capable of sweating more, then you need to be better hydrated. You need to basically perpetuate that whole system and allow your body to sweat more by providing what it sweats.
Yeah, you know, it's in one respect, it's not, we're used to that whole concept when we talk about work rate and feeding, right, with nutrition. We're used to thinking like, I'm burning this many kilojoules and I need to make sure that I'm replenishing a certain amount. But
and it's a little trickier when it comes to food because you know, your body metabolizes different substrates. But in this case, it's just water.
Yeah, the principles at work here of maintaining that balance is very important. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. So along with that, sweat sensitivity comes a couple other changes, and one of them is that, you know, like I said, you sweat sooner, but you also sweat more profusely. Your body's again better at thermoregulation. In this case, offloading heat. But it also, over time, your sweat glands themselves start to undergo particular adaptations. And one of them is that they get a little more better at reabsorbing sodium. So your electrolyte content in your sweat actually goes down. Your body gets better at holding on to these electrolytes that you otherwise would sacrifice if you weren't as heat adapted.
One thing too, jumping back just one little point that for dehydration, it is controversial about where like is good, but I've
in where, general, what do you mean by where?
What percentage of body weight you can lose before gotcha. Like oh, different yeah. performance things happen.
Yes.
In general, this is in general, okay? So please, no one advocate, I haven't seen anyone at least advocate increasing your hydration over the course of a ride. So I mean, like actually ending the ride where you have gained.
In a higher total body water state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like I haven't seen that. And I have seen people say a slight 1% mm-hmm. might be beneficial. You can get some weight loss.
Yeah.
There's quite a bit of information that supports yeah. the fact that, you know, you get that 1-2% decrease in total body water, increase in hydration, and your heart has to work harder. Your heart rate goes up and everything kind of goes downhill. But there's also a lot of science to support that as your body dehydrates, it doesn't necessarily limit performance as much as one would think. And some of the highest performing athletes do quite well and finish in a really dehydrated state. That's not to say we recommend dehydration or we say that it's not something that should be taken seriously, it's simply that you can get away with it. It's not necessarily something that's going to take you out of the game.
So I would, if you are screaming at your podcast right now, so that you can see some, and maybe it's
look up Tim Noakes. I mean, Tim has done, or Mr. Dr. Noakes has done a lot of research on this particular topic and has an entire book behind it. A whole lot of resources within that book too. So that's the extreme side, not even the extreme side, but that's the other side of things.
In general, I like to advocate of not being dehydrated.
Yeah,
it's just safer,
I agree
right?
Completely, yeah. I agree. If you have the means to hydrate, mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at marathon runners, it's pretty difficult for them to stay hydrated when they're pursuing, you know, a right. sub 2 hour marathon or even a 2:10 or something. But in our case, if you have access to it, there's no reason to be dehydrated.
Mm-hmm. I would say if you are an Olympian, a professional athlete, something like that, then maybe dive into the, what is the optimal rate of dehydration for this point in the race and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But for us guys, like for probably most of the people, if not all of the people listening to the podcast, mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a few Olympians on here, just like right. hydrate yourself, right?
Yeah.
The only other thing yeah. I want to say before about hydrating is, especially for marathon runners, is you can die drinking, it's called hypernatremia, is drinking too much water and not replacing your electrolytes. Yeah.
Sodium in particular.
Yeah, Chicago sodium. Marathon, people have done that there where it's been really hot in years. And usually it's a slower person where, because it takes a while to do this, is they might be walking the second half and they'll just be drinking water after water after water.
It's pounding the water and diluting their sodium stores.
Yep. And your body actually like shuts down and yeah. can't function and you can die.
It can go a real, real bad direction real fast.
Well, I've never heard of anyone dying because they ingested too much salt, like while they're working out.
No, your body's really good at regulating sodium content.
Yeah. So that's just another thing. Like, we're not advocating, please no one like try to like dehydrate yourself a bunch, and please don't overwater where you're going to give yourself hypernatremia.
Yeah, and also something on this too, that when in our discussions earlier on this, we were recognizing that there should be a separation that people should understand when we're talking about, we will be talking about hydration somewhat regularly throughout this, but the focus is on heat adaptation. And just because you have a lot of heat in your body, that doesn't mean that you are necessarily dehydrated. Those two things don't necessarily just, you know, work together quite as directly as you may assume.
You can be cold
uh-huh.
and dehydrated, and you can be hot and
well hydrated.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. So if like somebody says, oh, I just cooked in the heat, usually the first question is, did you drink enough? And sure, you know, that can certainly help as recovering here, but at the same time, it doesn't necessarily mean that that was the core problem. Mm-hmm.
And I think during Carson City for me, I was both dehydrated and hot. Like if I was, I would still have.
Yeah,
exactly. We had both.
We all were underprepared.
I have plenty of water.
Oh yeah, did have plenty of water, didn't you?
Yep.
I didn't and Nate didn't. Yeah. And yep. It definitely had an effect.
That's why Jonathan beat us.
But we all, yeah.
Pretty much the only
That's
reason.
The sole reason, yeah.
Sole
but
reason.
That's a good example of, I guess, the break in that right there, right? So yeah. Plenty of water in one, but all of us suffered from the same.
I just want to say that one more time. You can be, so Jonathan, he was not heat adapted. That lowered his power during the race day. He felt horrible, but he had plenty of water.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Just
hydration like was not an issue.
So back to the adaptations that come with heat adaptation. There are ones that occur at the cellular level, and they revolve around something called heat shock proteins. We don't need to get into the science of it, but just know that these things actually prevent and or protect against and accelerate repair from heat stress. So all the bad things that heat stress does to your body, these work in favor of restoring, you know, that or correcting that damage, and largely is done so by reducing the inflammatory response. But there's a whole lot of sciencey aspects of that that we don't really need to go into. Just suffice it to say, it happens all the way down at that level.
Interesting.
And then the big thing that I think most people chase, and the thing that gets touted most highly, is the increase in plasma volume. So when you consider the components of your blood, for our purposes, we're just going to talk about, you know, the red blood cells that carry the oxygen, and the plasma, which is the fluid portion of it. We don't need to get into the other components of it for our discussion here. But the fact is, the heat adaptation grows the volume of that. And basically that just puts more fluid in your blood, more fluid that can be circulated to below the skin and then sweat it out. Mm-hmm. So basically your cooling capacity or your ability to thermoregulate increases.
That's an interesting thing that I think. So basically it's almost like putting more fluid into a radiator of a car. When you're running low on that fluid in the car, there's not enough fluid in there, it doesn't have enough time to act, or it just stays hot.
But it also is going to add weight too, right?
It does. Yeah. I mean, with fluid comes additional body weight, but the impact of the body weight increase is offset drastically by the increased thermoregulation, mm-hmm. and what's called cardiovascular stability, which is basically, you know, your heart doesn't fluctuate as wildly. You don't have to pump as much blood. Either way, your body reacts in a more moderate manner.
Basically, too, you can put out more power, which we're going to talk about. So even though you weigh a little bit more, it gets the benefits of putting out more power is better.
Yeah, absolutely outweighs the increased weight gain. And that weight gain is temporary too. I mean, if you're sweating some of this out over the course of an event and you're not replacing all of it, mm-hmm. you're basically losing weight over the course of that event.
I keep going back to Kona, where I would so do this, because you start the swim, which can be warm in the warm water, and then you do start on the bike, and it's pretty much flat for the first part of it, but it's gonna get hot. And then the run where the weight's really going to be effective, you probably lost all that weight anyways, but you still have the heat adaptation of being able to cool more properly. That's like, I see no negatives for Kona. Like, you should be, I mean, most races, but just Kona is like the
great example. Yeah. I mean, luckily, I guess they have a lot of wind on the Queen K, but
I mean, you got a warm water swim and then you're into a hot, humid environment.
It kind of felt like you were standing behind the exhaust in a semi truck pretty much.
It was incredible. I'm glad we did it toward the end of our trip and not at the beginning, because I would have fallen apart.
Yeah. It's a hairdryer.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Yeah,
when you're standing on a stove and someone's got a hairdryer on you.
Yeah,
there it is.
Yeah, that's pretty much Kona.
One point I want to make is, you know, we're chasing these increases in plasma volume, right? This plasma volume expansion is the term, but the fact is that basic endurance training does some of that on its own. So this isn't the only way. I mean, as you improve as an endurance athlete and do more endurance training, more aerobic training, this plasma volume expansion is a byproduct of that training itself. So this is a way to further that.
Chad, do we know is there like a thing we could apply across the board to different people as far as like this much training will bring about this much increase in plasma volume or anything like that?
And we'll talk about basically the time course of heat adaptation training a little later on. So yeah, there is pretty much a finite timeline in which you can achieve these adaptations
for non-heat adaptation.
For general, I can't say.
Cool. Perfect. Okay. So does that more or less cover, I guess we're talking about
kind of detail oriented scientific attributes or the different ways the body adapts. I'm not sure we're really going to benefit from covering all that in this greater detail.
I feel like we could probably have a 6 weeks course.
Yeah, seriously. Exactly. As I started to dig into this, I mean, literally hours went by before.
Here's what you need to know. If you're heat adapted, benefits happen to your body and you can put out more power. That's what it is. Yeah, and if you really want to know there's like 14 things that happen, you can research each one of them.
You basically get closer and closer to where you were prior to experiencing the heat. So if you train in a temperate environment and you have certain capabilities, then you go into the heat and you sacrifice or some of those capabilities seem to have dissipated. They're still there. Your body just won't allow you to express them. But as you get more and more adapted to the heat, you rise back to the level at which you can operate in a more temperate climate.
Yeah, and we'll have a blog post on blog.trainerroad.com with this information, links to the studies, everything else. So by the time you listen to this, you'll be able to have that information, which will be pretty cool. So,
and there is actually one more thing that since we were talking about dehydration, another of the benefits of heat adaptation is that it confers a protective benefit against dehydration. You actually become a little more sensitive to what your body needs. So when people suggest that ad libitum drinking, where you basically drink to thirst, this heightens your sensitivity to when your body needs water.
Interesting.
That's really interesting. So to bring it back to the glycogen loading that we were talking about, I think 2 or 3 episodes ago, mm-hmm. where when you do that, you actually gain some water, and that would also help with being more hydration.
Yeah.
Like this, I'm thinking again of Kona. Again, another event that you're going to need so much glycogen for your...
Just pack as much water in there as you can.
And then you, especially the swim, who cares? And the bike is flat pretty much for the first 40 miles, besides a little teeny climb out of town.
Yeah,
it'd be a good strategy, I think, for triathletes to do both glycogen loading and heat adaption, pack a bunch of water.
Yeah. Chad, do you want to get into the humidity side of things?
Yeah. So if we touch on humidity a little bit, because you look at heat adaptation training, and a lot of the studies are done in dry climates or in dry circumstances, and it changes pretty drastically in some ways and not so much in other ways. So if you do your heat adaptation training in a hot and a humid environment, you get slightly different changes. You still see those same increases in plasma volume, but not necessarily the same changes that you would see in both stroke volume and cardiac output. So those more central changes aren't as pronounced, or they might not even be there if you're doing this heat adaptation training in a humid environment.
Wait, so shoot.
Yeah, so exactly. But if you need to be adapted to human environments, it does make sense. I mean, this still goes back to specificity. Mm-hmm. If you do all your adaptation training in a dry climate and then you go and compete at something like Kona, that you're going to experience effects and a situation that you're not accustomed to. And a lot of these...
But in general, Jonathan and I turned the shower on to raise the humidity, and I think I was at 70%.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure it's productive if we're not going to be training in humid environments. There's no real benefit to doing, none that I've found, to doing heat adaptation training in a humid environment if you're not actually going to race in one.
I read that too, and it was like the dry, you got more benefit in the dry benefit.
You can do more. I mean, again, we're talking about evaporative cooling, and humidity absolutely works in the face flies in the face of that. It doesn't allow you to dissipate that heat because the humidity of the environment conflicts with the moisture on your skin, and it doesn't move, so that cooling doesn't take place.
That makes sense. So your capacity might be a little more capped in that humid environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Two things on this. Number one, I guess, is it better to be training in a hot and humid environment than if you're trying to seek heat adaptation? Is it better to be training in one where you have humidity? Because the one thing I'm thinking of is if you're in a small room that you can get hot enough or anything else
that. It's going to get humid.
You're going to make it humid because
you're going to deal with some
breath,
level of humidity.
Because of sweat, something else like that. But so you're still getting heat adaptation and benefit from it, right?
Yeah, I think it's just going to limit your work rate even more.
That makes sense.
Unless you can put yourself in a dry sauna, I don't know, or your university.
You have to have something that's drying out the air somehow that's keeping it hot, you know, whether it's circulating hot air that's coming through.
That'd be hard.
Yeah, but the short of it is that humidity absolutely has an impact, and it makes something that's already a pretty difficult process, you know, heat adaptation, an even more difficult one.
And it's worth us mentioning that in our specific cases, the heat that we endured at Carson City Off-Road was not humid. It was very dry.
Oh, yeah. Very dry. That works in our favor.
Yeah.
So we can train in that environment, and then we also go and race in that environment.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much just telling us we got off easy on that one, Chad, and it could have been much worse.
But very, very succinctly, consider your race conditions and acclimate accordingly.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I know what we have, 70.3 World Championships coming up. Those are in Chattanooga. I'm sure is going to be very humid.
Humid.
For those that are getting ready, I know that Masters, or actually just a lot of national champs, road national champs just finished up back east. Mountain bike national championships this year are back east in West Virginia.
It's part of the reason that I frankly wasn't very interested in them.
Yeah. And very good ideas to consider that. Also, something, and this just is away from perhaps the studies, but in most cases, as you raise up in elevation, you're going to see less humidity in most cases in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. For example, we had a podcast listener who came out and visited us last week, and he was from right where Mountain Bike National Champs is. So I'm hoping to go next year, not this year. So I was grilling him for information. And he was choking because it was so dry at first in the beginning of the ride. But he was saying that relatively speaking, because the elevation was, I think it was around 2,000 to 3,000 feet at the snowshoe ski resort, he said, "Oh, it's dry up there. Much more humid than what we're used to, but for them, it's drier." So make sure you really look into not just like, oh, it's back east or it's in the south, it's humid, but look into the specifics there.
And then just real quick, one other thing that we'll touch on before we get into the nitty gritty is that the magnitude of these improvements is dependent on a number of things. One's the environment. We just kind of touched on that. Basically, we're talking dry heat versus humid heat. The adaptation regimen itself, we'll get into detail on that real soon here. And then, of course, the exercise intensity. And then the subject population. So, I mean, are you deconditioned? Are you highly conditioned?
I'm highly.
Yeah, but this is all going to influence just how much or how much of a benefit you garner from this heat adaptation training.
Yeah. You ready to get into what happens?
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I like it. Actually, should we get into how you should do it and the protocol actually behind it?
Let's talk about what the effects of actual heat adaptation training are.
Cool.
And then we can talk about how to do the said training.
I dig it. All right.
Okay.
Take it away, Chad.
What's important to know is that it happens pretty rapidly. The difference between your first day's performance, you know, relative to what you were doing in a temperate climate, then you go into a hot one, that first day is going to suck. It's not going to be great. And there was one study where they had subjects do a 100-minute walk first day. None of them, or I'm sorry, 100, did I say 100-minute?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Last time I wrote it down, it's 100-mile. 100-minute walk. First day, nobody could do it. But by 10 of them, but by that third day, 10 of them could do it. By the fifth day, 20 of them could do it. And then by that seventh day of heat acclimation, in their case, it was acclimation, all but one of them could do it. So the fact is it didn't take long. 3 days into it, a lot of them could do it. 7 days into it, pretty much all of them could do it. And then a similar study with a 43K time trial. So it's called a 40K time trial. They did it in cold and then they did it in the heat. And after 1 week of heat acclimation training, they were partway back to what they were at with their, you know, their baseline measure after 2 weeks, full return, almost full power.
After 2 weeks, they put out just as much power, almost
very
as
close
much in the hot weather as they did in the cold weather.
Exactly. So 2 weeks, I mean, we're not talking a long time frame here, but you know, what happens in those 2 weeks, that's what's important.
Is that doing it every single day?
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know for my first workout in the shower there in the hot weather, or in the hot conditions and humid conditions, it was really hard for me.
I tried Baxter and I turned it down up to 10%.
Yeah.
And then I gave up after an hour. Yeah. And someone on Strava commented, "Chad wouldn't have given up." I was like, you know what, Chad?
Chad's training harder than you.
Chad's not doing it.
Actually, so. Chad's not training as hard as you.
It was really hard. I had a few moments where I actually felt like I was on the rollers in the shower, which always makes it a little more scary. But I had a few moments where I stopped and I thought, I need to pour some cold water on me really quick. I'm getting real warm, you know?
How long did you go for?
It was an hour. Yeah.
And what? Mm. Oh, so I made it maybe 30 seconds longer than you. What workout was it?
I can't remember the...
Endurance, though?
It was endurance. The intensity was everywhere between 40... Well, I mean, in the warm-ups and cool-downs, down to like 40%, but it was in between 50 to 65% of FTP, so...
Yeah, it doesn't take much. And that's a surprising thing. And it'll make an hour-long workout at 50 to 60, 65% FTP a really, really long hour.
It was rough.
So long.
It's amazing. It's amazing how hard this is.
To give an example of how the performance decreased for me... for Baxter last week, I did one interval, 219 watts. Average heart rate for that interval, 119. Okay.
And so then this interval is how long? I mean, we're talking.
I just 2 minutes. Baxter is like little teeny steps, right, in between.
A lot of little ones.
The previous one, my heart rate was maybe 117 or 118.
Okay, so short interval.
Short interval, but it's my heart rate didn't change a lot. Same one in the shower with it really hot. Same wattage. Instead of my heart rate being 119, it was 162.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So 219 watts, 162.
And there might have been mitigating factors. I mean, maybe you were a little fatigued. Maybe there could be other things, but the fact is, big difference.
Yes.
Big jump.
Big
jump in the stress on your heart and your cardiovascular system.
Yeah.
And this is what we're talking about with that cardiovascular stability that we're trying to achieve. Nate does not have it right now.
I wasn't doing anything different, right? I do my hard day, easy day, off. And this was hard day, shower day. Yeah. And then I had an off day
yesterday. So you even intentionally tried to minimize those other variables and still saw this big of a fluctuation.
Exactly. Go ahead, Jonathan.
That withstanding, there still are, of course, we should recognize this. We should place the grain of salt on the table that is heart rate, right? Heart rate always is vulnerable to various fluctuations and outside.
But in any case, this is a big enough jump that it's pretty obvious. His heart's doing a lot more work.
119 to 162. So what I hoped it happened is, that's a good point with the heart rate, but my plan, and we'll see if this is right after we get into it more, but I'm going to do a hard day, shower day with Baxter. I just really like Baxter. If you follow me, I really like Baxter. And then I'll do the third day, instead of taking an off day, I'm going to do Baxter again with normal cooling with fans, nothing special. So hard day, shower day, easy day. Do that two in a row and then a day off. So that's a 7-day split right there.
So basically you're doing your heat adaptation training every third day.
Every third day, yep. And I would like to see on the same workout that after a while I can finish the 90 minutes and then I don't have to turn it down at all. Mm-hmm. And then it just starts to get the same.
And you'll see that very thing. You'll see it on a slower time course than if you were to train every day, every other day. But you know, that's something that's coming up real quick here, maybe the next topic.
I don't think I have enough mental willpower to do this every day or every other day.
Yeah, I think if you were to, you would have to, in your case, tone it down a bit. Maybe they're 30-minute workouts, 40-minute workouts.
Yeah, and let's cover something. I mean, you don't want to. So, Nate, you're training with specific objectives to trend your power output, whether that's FTP or your ability to exploit that in a specific way. You're working towards something. It's not as if you have time to burn. So that's something that's important here. If you just end up doing these, you know, lower intensity workouts that are with heat, and you're searching those heat adaptations, and that's it, sure, you can do that. But otherwise, you want to make sure that you're working it in intelligently so that it doesn't derail any other progress towards something.
Yeah, that's a good point, is that if I find that I cannot accomplish my my hard intervals, my hard days, mm-hmm. I'm going to drop the third easy day. Mm-hmm. And then if I get so much out of the heat training, I'm going to probably go to an easier workout and maybe go 40%.
Yeah.
It's almost a little silly what I'm doing. I want the cool weather benefits, but I'm doing this up until single track 6, which is in 1 month from now. Yeah. And I want the benefits of that, because it could be like in the 80s with some humidity, maybe probably dry, but some. That's still hot enough that it's not the cool office environment that I'm used to training in.
But see, the beauty of this is these adaptations take place at all intensity levels. I mean, it may take a little more time to do it. I mean, you have the benefit of being, what are we, 3 weeks out?
No, four weeks out.
Okay, yeah, so we're a good ways out. So you have a lot of time to work with that. So you can do it at a slower pace. If, however, you're pressed for time, you know, that definitely changes things.
Mm-hmm. Also, something, and I feel like we've been mentioning this specifically in the context of heat, but just touching back to something that we hit on a little bit earlier, but this will benefit you even if you're not racing in the heat. There are benefits outside of that.
There
as well.
Are, yep. So. Pretty well confirmed too.
Yep. Yeah. So there are benefits outside of that. Are we ready to get into how you should lace this into?
Yeah. So now we can talk about, you know, how long does it take for these adaptations to set in? And then, you know, how do you go about, you know, how frequently do you have to do it, at what intensity, you know, the duration of the workouts themselves, et cetera. A lot of leeway here, but it's much like anything else in that the dose kind of dictates. So, you know, the intensity, the frequency of it, how consistent, et cetera. But the good news is 75 to 80% of the adaptations, and this is based again on that paper, a lot of citations. So if you want to dig into that, we'll absolutely post that link, and you can get into each one of those studies and see whether or not you can get behind it. But lots of research to support what I'm about to share with you. 75 to 80% of the adaptations happen really quickly, first 4 to 7 days. Mm-hmm. Then you get, you know, another uptick over the next 8 to 14 days, and then greater than 15 is what they call long-term acclimation.
And so during that period, that's an everyday thing?
Yeah, so let me get to that.
Okay.
So over the course of that first 4 to 7 days is where you see the big reductions in heart rate. So the big swings Nate's seeing right now, if he were to do this more frequently, or as he gets into this, you know, further into it, he's going to see that heart rate come down, down, down. And typically, they're complete by that seventh session. And I think that seventh session implies that you're doing 7 days in a row. I don't think Nate's every third day thing. I think that basically grows to 3 times the duration. So he's going to see that same completion of heart rate reduction after about 3 weeks rather than 7.
And we've seen, a question of mine before we recorded this was, if I'm doing it every third day, can I get the same benefit?
There is a study that supports exactly that.
Yep, that was three. Because most of them are every day or every other day, but mm-hmm. the majority is every day, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's at least one that we found.
Yeah, and I've got that on here, so we'll get to that really.
Can I just keep interrupting you?
That's fine. Sorry, everybody. Fine. It breaks it up. Otherwise, I'm just going to be spewing forth a bunch of information and probably losing people about 10 seconds in. So then improvements in skin and core temp, and those are big concerns, right? We want a reduction in core temperature and a reduction in our skin temperature happens after about a week, 7 days. Other thermoregulatory benefits take place within that 10 to 14 days span. So basically what I'm telling you is after about 2 weeks of this sort of training, you can expect to see most of the improvements or the adaptation that you can expect.
2 weeks of every day.
Regardless of how long you drag it out. Yep. That's my understanding. So
interesting.
There's a physiological tolerance for it that may take longer. So there are other adaptations that will take longer than the initial 2 weeks. So the optimal dosage for this, based on a number of the studies in this and other ones that I've read, is continuous daily exposure to dry heat for 100 minutes. So we're talking some pretty rigorous sessions. If you can make yourself get on the bike, in this case, 7 days in a row, 100 minutes at a time, and that the temperature too changes. Mm-hmm. I've seen different studies that have people, the consensus seems to be right around 100, 101 degrees. So it doesn't have to be crazy hot, but it definitely has to be pretty uncomfortably hot.
That's crazy hot.
Yeah. It is, but I've seen studies where they talk about, in my post-sauna sessions that I do after hard workouts, I put it up to 130 degrees. But of course, I'm sitting there. I'm not doing any work.
Yeah.
Something that's interesting on this is that studies have shown that just doing it once a week doesn't have that.
Nope.
One week has no
adaptive effect. And then Nate's every third day thing, it basically translates to three times as long. So the effects you could achieve over 7 days doing it daily are going to take 3 weeks doing it every third day.
So this is kind of cool. Is I'm timing this tried it for single track six to get some kind of benefit with all the other things we talked about. But so we're talking about doing these workouts, and if you do them every day, your quality sessions, you cannot do the quality sessions during this.
No, so you're going to have to figure out some balance there.
And that's what
obviously.
I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure out a balance.
Yeah. And you've got the luxury of time. But if you're someone who has a high level of conditioning and you've got, a week before your big race and you want to spend it all in the sauna trying to heat acclimate, mm-hmm. probably not going to cost yourself a whole lot of fitness in the process. You're going to be maintaining your aerobic fitness because you're on the bike for 100 minutes every day, 7 days in a row. So there are situations where, this more extreme approach will work real well.
I just want to get off. I want to just stress that what I'm doing is I'm doing a cool environment, quality interval session. Then I'm doing the heat stuff, mm-hmm. and they're two different workouts because you cannot have the quality with the heat at the same time. Mm-hmm. You could do it in there. You're just not going to be able to produce.
Yeah, you can.
The amount of wattage.
We'll talk about that too. There are suggestions for how you can maximize power output and still do it in the heat, but it will come at the expense of the quality of your workout. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're doing a total of 20 minutes of VO2 max work inside of an hour in temperate conditions, you're not going to be able to do that in a 100 degree room. Like that, if ever.
Yeah.
Huh. So I guess, should we, so Nate, you're talking about looping them in so that you have your high intensity days and then you're timing this with the low intensity stuff. Could this be something, once again, we're getting back into the semantics that you said we weren't going to, but moving from moving over to acclimatization, is this something where somebody, I'm thinking of like a person that rides mountain bikes specifically because they might be getting out working on skills on a trail or something like mm-hmm. that. Maybe they live in a hot environment. Mm-hmm. Is 90 to 100 degree Fahrenheit heat, is this enough to bring about adaptations if they try to pair their longer rides just outside?
Yeah, and it's actually really effective too. And there's plenty of science that has supported or research that has supported how there's a greater adaptive effect if you do long-term acclimatization rather than short-term acclimation.
Interesting.
So actually getting out in the environment, mm-hmm. in the natural, working on trails, doing stuff that is very similar to what you'll do during, your events or even just, riding.
Mm-hmm. So the way too I've applied that to myself is, do your quality indoor sessions. And then when you're doing a long endurance training outside, you could go in the middle of the day when it's like, 95, yeah. 100.
Get out and get some heat training.
Yep. And you're getting benefit from being in the heat. I know a lot of people, they always, and especially with group rides, everyone messages, we're starting at 7 a.m. to beat the heat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to some extent, that makes sense. But if you know you're going to have to race in the heat, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who's made this mistake, you do all your training in a cool environment, and then you go out there and you think your fitness is high and you're just going to rip it. And guys who aren't as fit as you but are adapted to the heat beat you up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you're trying to chase a power number, which is probably the worst.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
So tonight I'm doing a hill climb.
It will crack you.
I'm the only one who is who's brave enough. Both of you guys.
That's what it is.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, we're doing an hour. It's pretty much an hour long hill climb tonight.
Yeah.
And it's going to be in the heat. And it's going to be hot.
Shouldn't be too bad.
Shouldn't be too bad, moderate but heat. It's still going to be.
It's not going to be as hot as Carson off road, but it will
certainly
be.
Certainly not. You'll be about 15 to 20 degrees less because you're climbing up to 8,000 feet. And always, because Mother Nature knows when this race is and she marks her calendar, she'll throw wind at you the whole way up too. So you'll have evaporative cooling from the wind,
That'll help.
And you'll be at higher elevation drying out. That will also help. And you'll be cooling off as you go up in elevation too.
So maybe this time it won't affect me as much, but I just want to, my point is, if let's say my FTP is 305 and it's an hour long climb and I'm like, I feel fresh, I'm going to aim for 305. If it's a hot environment and I start at 305, oh man, that's going to feel like starting at 325 in a cool environment because it's going to, your power is limited so much that you're going to start out too hard and then you're just, it's going to be the worst feeling ever.
It's going to fall apart over the course of it and have to gut it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be make for a very, very bad day. So the takeaway is just if you're in a hot environment, start even lower than you would if you're not heat adapted.
So a takeaway for this too, really quick on knowing the course, not just the location, but knowing the course really helps. I'm sure that anybody listening to this can think of a specific spot on a climb, and it might be like it's encapsulated in trees or something in that area, or there's a creek running by and it gets really steep. And you know that in that spot, it's really going to get humid as well as maybe just hot or a spot where you're exposed to the sun for an extended period of time, whatever it may be. Nate, you'll have a section where you'll actually kind of tuck away from the wind about, maybe a third of the way into this one. So that's a spot where you'll probably still have some sun, but you'll be gone from the wind for a bit. And that, something to consider.
We've all done long climbs that are shielded from the wind.
Yeah.
But this one's actually, I'm going to wear my aero helmet on this climb.
Very smart.
Because the relative wind speed.
Is this smart? I think the cooling might be a bit of an issue.
Actually, no. You bring up
does that helmet breathe very well?
It's a good trade off.
Okay. It does. It breathes well. But if I'm going let's say I'm going 8 miles per hour, but the wind's going 25 miles per hour.
Yeah.
And then I'm going 33 miles per hour, effective wind speed. So I want an aero helmet than a really well-vented wave. That's a ventilated one.
That's a good point though, Chad, of bringing up the trade off between.
Yeah, it's definitely something to consider. So just to reiterate really quickly that ideally you're scheduling this a couple weeks out from your event. If you can work in seven, as many as 14 sessions. So if you can do it every other day, ideally every day, leading into it, it's the consistency that is vital. Whether or not you're doing it every third day, it has to take place every third day. You start stretching that out and those adaptations are going to start to fade.
Yeah, and once again, just reiterating the fact that you want to be keeping your training on track here. And like you said, Chad, if you're highly conditioned, you're kind of primed and ready, and you just want to add in this piece of the puzzle, this is the way to do it.
Heat adaptation cramming, almost. Yeah.
Okay, so we've talked about how often you have to do it to get the benefits, but what's the actual protocol that people have seen that create benefits, and then how much benefit do they actually get?
Sure. So there's definite flexibility in there. And again, it relates to that whole duration, intensity, and all the things that apply to workouts. So different doses manufacture different results on different timelines. But a couple of the studies that we did look at, one was done by the University of Oregon back in 2010, and they used cyclists. They did 10 days of heat acclimation. Maybe they're outside. Heat acclimation training, 100 minutes of exercise in heat each day. And these guys saw a 5% jump in VO2 max measured in cool conditions by the end of the study. So this had an impact on their training in back in that temperate environment. So training in the heat actually benefited their general performance.
So in this one too, they 5% jump in VO2 max in cool conditions and 8% jump in hot conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But they also measured power lactic threshold, which is probably easier for us. And it was a 5% increase in both cool conditions and hot conditions.
Yeah.
So this is the amazing thing is, these people did, and I believe we tried to look it up, but I think it's all aerobic like an aerobic ride for 100 minutes.
Yeah, we're talking like 60, maybe 70% of FTP.
And they got a 5% increase in FTP in hot and cold conditions. So it's single track six, 5% for me, well, 15 watts. That's 15 watts. If I can do 15 more watts than Chad and not in this end like a
just
person,
Chad, not anybody else. I don't care. Just Chad.
It's just one on one.
How about
man.
15 more watts than you can do right now? Isn't that a big deal?
You can?
What? No, I'm just saying. You can compare you to you.
Yeah. Okay. So if I can do 15 more watts, that's going to, I mean, just think about it. Your average power of 15 more watts. That is gigantic. Yeah. Right?
It's a big change.
Yep. And then real quick, another protocol was used in a New Zealand study, and they did it on rowers, and they used a shorter protocol for just 5 days, again, 90 minutes a day. They only worked them hard enough to put them at a slight bump, a modest overheating level of, again, 101 degrees core temp. And same thing, 5 day acclimation period, 2 weeks before their major championship, they saw a 1.5% increase in their 2000 meter rowing performance. And this is at the very high level or at a very high level. So an elite level anyway, whatever that constitutes.
And two though, that New Zealand study was done in a humid environment of 60% relative humidity.
Yeah, that's worth mentioning. Yep.
Yep. And then the other one too, I just actually read it. The University of Oregon study, 50% of VO2 max was their training.
There you go. Yeah, so we're talking, you know, 70% of threshold-ish. Yeah,
not so bad. Yeah, kind of right around, maybe a little bit higher than Baxter, but right around there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the point is, you don't have to do real hard work. Mm-hmm. It'll feel hard, but you know, you won't actually be doing a whole lot of
Rest
work.
Rest assured, it will feel hard.
Yeah. So I think this is what I would like to do. And then for us, and I don't really want to recommend heat. We don't recommend this at all because I don't want anyone to die.
Yeah.
But for us individually, if we have enough time, quality session and then easy session, just to reiterate that, because doing all of this or cramming all of this is going to be super tough.
Yep.
Super tough on you.
And so another fancy term is the induction pathway you utilize. So in this case, it's basically how do you induce the adaptations? How do you go about it? And they do there's a couple different ways. One's like constant work rate exercise, where you basically just work at, you know, like Nate's doing, a steady 60 to 70% over the course of, you know, whatever time span. There's controlled hyperthermia, where they try to target a particular core temperature and then stay at that core temperature. And that has really good effects as well.
Yeah.
And then there's
remember really quick, and what Chad said was hyperthermia. We're used to saying hypothermia. It's very rare that we bring up hyper, but this is the case.
And then there's a controlled intensity, which is basically a heart rate modulated one. So they put it at a heart rate and then they do whatever amount of work is required to stay at that same heart rate, regardless of the changes in the temperature. So the point is there's a lot of different ways to go about it. And that's acclimation as far as natural heat acclimatization. Yeah, you know, that's again, specificity. Do what you're going to have to do in competition. Go out and try to simulate those demands.
All right, so let's get into how long this lasts or what the drop-off is on this stuff.
Yeah, and this was the sad science of it all, or the lack thereof. I even posted this on the Google wattage group and got no feedback whatsoever. So I think people don't know. A lot of people read it. Nobody responded. So both in the research and this paper that I've been citing so much, there is no agreement. One thing they do agree on is that the training regularity remains high.
No agreement on how quickly
these effects dissipate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Assuming you've stopped doing it.
Yeah.
Right.
So basically just keep up your aerobic fitness, because the aerobic fitness is a absolutely critical aspect to these adaptations. Your aerobic fitness declines, the adaptive effects of this heat training are going to go with them. There was one study that was a little encouraging that talked about for every day in the heat, you can spend 5 outside of it. So, you know, how well this study was constructed, I don't know, but I like the idea that all I have to do is one day to basically maintain these heat adaptive, these heat adaptations.
After you've been heat adapted, it just takes 1 out of 5 to keep
that's,
it.
That's what this particular study
Let's
claimed.
Believe it, because
I want
to. No, this is actually the way that like is not the absolute. The opposite of science is you want to believe it, so you believe it.
Yeah, your mileage may vary there, right? That's what we're getting.
But there is a fair amount of evidence to support that short-term acclimation, so basically what we're describing here, up to about 2 weeks worth of acclimation, that the adaptations persist for about a week, but not much longer.
Oh, that's so depressing.
Yeah.
Because
that assumes you've ceased all your heat training.
But it's so painful, right? So like you do all this work and then you get it for
goes
a week
away
or
fast.
Two.
Yeah.
I was hoping for 6 months.
Yeah, no, not even close.
It's kind of interesting too, because a lot of the time you'll be tapering for a big event that you're preparing for and trying to emulate the circumstances and everything else, whether it's a championship of some sort, whatever it is. And a lot of the time in that taper, you'll be, you know, depending on, I know for me personally, my tapering strategy usually has, you know, higher intensity work, but just cut down on the volume, right? But if I'm trying to mix in the heat training, that's tricky. Like
extra stress, right?
It is extra stress.
It is tricky, but there are methods around that. And I'm going to get to one of them that I've actually employed and worked for me. And there is a couple of studies that actually back it up.
So a lot of people too said to stop heat training before your like A event.
Saw this in a few places. They talked about stopping it a week before because of some of the deleterious effects of heat training so that you can kind of rebound from those. But in the process, you're going to lose some of the adaptation, primarily that plasma volume expansion.
And so that's the part where we don't know the answer. And that's what the question you asked. We don't know why.
I don't know if there is a hard answer to it. Yeah. It might be that they, again, there's no consensus on how quickly these effects dissipate.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So I guess, are we ready to wrap it up with some
takeaways? So yeah, so now we can talk about, you know, different forms of hyperthermic training and wrap this up.
Cool.
There are, so we've basically ad nauseum so far covered the touted benefits of heat adaptation. Some people have referred to this as hyperthermic conditioning. And that's actually the conditioning that yields the heat adaptation. So heat training, basically. It increases blood flow to skeletal muscle is what we're primarily concerned with, but also to the heart and skin, two, you know, very big concerns, especially when it comes to offloading heat. Reduced rate of glycogen depletion. So, you know, basically this improved muscle perfusion, this blood flow to the muscles can have a positive effect on how much glycogen you use. And then other things like increased red blood cell, better oxygen transport, et cetera. So there's a lot of benefit to it, and we can get this in a number of ways. Straightforward in terms of outdoor workouts, if you want to get out there and actually acclimatize, basically it's kind of up to you. If you can hit the peak temperatures in the afternoon and spend an hour, even 100 minutes, 2 hours out there, you know, good on you. That's going to have a positive effect over time. If necessary, you don't have those high temperatures, layer up a bit. You know, maybe put on some extra clothing and get out there at the hottest time of day that you can manage based on your work shift or whatever your life's obligations are. And then, of course, indoor training, which, you know, we've got plenty of advice on this matter, and I imagine we'll talk more about this in the future, but just what Nate and Jonathan have already talked about, which is working out in the shower, you can do the same thing in a laundry room. You can create quite a lot of humidity if you have a lot of laundry, or a small laundry room and a load of laundry going.
But again, though, humidity might not be as beneficial as dry if you're going to race at a dry condition.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you turned on the dryer and had that going, or in your kitchen had the oven, hey, there we go. Workout by 11.
If you want dry,
don't do that.
Don't catch on fire. But
what I have for us is a little electric space heater that we can put inside the bathroom. Yeah, it's a small room.
It doesn't take much, though. I mean, even like I said, and this is the next one, is simply turning off your fan.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how it is when you do a warm up, maybe your fan's not on, or you get partway into a workout and realize you didn't turn the fan on. That has a big impact on the quality of the work or the amount of work you can do.
Yeah. And though I don't know if that's, like, we don't have a study that says, if you just do that, is that going to then increase your power output? Like, because all these are all at 101. Yeah. I even had problems getting the room to 101.
Oh, yeah.
I felt like I had never been so hot in my life. Mm-hmm. But I think I got it to like 94 or something. But I was also 70% humidity.
But it's a higher core temperature. And that's what we're after. That's what we're after. So it's not as much about the ambient temperature of the room as what's happening to your core temp. And of course, you know, we don't know what the core temp is, short of inserting a thermometer somewhere unpleasant. But you know when you're hot. And if you keep repeating the same workout in the same environment with these same variables and you start sweating earlier, more profusely, et cetera, you recognize there is some level of heat adaptation taking place. So in all cases, whatever you modify that makes the environment hotter and raises your core temperature that bit, that much more is a reduction in the volume of your intensity is what's recommended. So you don't necessarily have to sacrifice intensity. I mean, we're not advocating that you do your VO2 max work in this hot environment, but if you should so choose, then, you know, 3 minute efforts become 2 minute efforts, or maybe they become 1.5 minute efforts with a 30 second gap in between them. In either case, you can only do so much work before your body's going to start to limit your resources, before cooling is going to take the priority and kind of shut you down.
Yeah.
So if you can kind of monitor that rise in core temperature and do so by stretching the workout or reshaping it a bit, you know, that's one method. That's one way to go about it.
Hmm. Interesting stuff. And it also, one thing also that you have noted up here on the doc that we're looking at, Chad, is that, and this makes sense, we talked about if you're working for acclimatization, once again, just outside stuff, and you're working to emulate the demands that you'd have in your event, whatever it may be, working not just in terms of the actual conditions, ambient conditions, but also the intensity. If you're outside, that can be beneficial, right?
Indeed. And then so outdoor workouts, indoor workouts, and then some of the alternate interventions, some different ways you can go about this. There are things called heat baths. There are heat chambers if you have access to, you know, a sports physiology department at a university. Mm-hmm. And then there's sauna training. And sauna training is both, you know, doing your training in a sauna and doing post-workout sauna sessions.
All right. So I guess that more or less covers what we have here on this one. Once again, you can go to blog.trainerroad.com and you'll see up there a blog post that we have on heat adaptation and really the focus on how to make yourself faster with it, regardless of the conditions that you'll be facing. You can submit your questions to us at trainerroad.com/podcast and we will come through them and we'll talk to you all next week. Hopefully this has made you faster too. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Just before I say bye-bye, just please don't be an idiot about this, right?
Like, yes, like, disclaimer.
Be sensible,
right? Yeah.
Yes. And it's easy to get in over your head with this.
Yes.
So, yes.
It is. Be careful. There is potential damage to be done. So, be sensible.
And talk to your doctor. Bye-bye.
Bye.